Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. Imperialism is a stage of capitalism that's wrecking the world, especially the global South. But why does capitalism need imperialism? How did neoliberal capitalism adapt after World War II to maintain its dominance? And how is it fueling neo-fascist movements today? To answer this and more, I'm joined by renowned Marxist economist Utsa Patnaik. She's the author of many books, including A Theory of Imperialism, and the more recent, Capital and Imperialism, Theory, History, and the Present, co-authored with Prabhat Patnaik. Utsa, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me to have this, I think, very important discussion. I'm such a huge admirer of your work. I've learned so much from it. And I guess a good place to start would be, you know, what is the importance, do you think, of Marxism today in understanding how the countries of the global South continue to suffer from their wealth being drained by imperialism in past centuries?
Well, Marxism is absolutely essential for understanding the phenomena you've just mentioned, because it is only in Marxist theory that we have the concept of economic surplus as a very central concept, the concepts of accumulation of capital, and also the concept of the primitive accumulation of capital, all of which are absolutely essential for understanding the phenomena of colonialism and imperialism. And it is not simply a question of the impact of colonialism and imperialism on the global South, but also its impact on the global North, in making the global North what it is, industrialized, because this is a process of what has been often called the Great Divergence, which really started only from somewhere around the middle of the 18th century. Before that, there was not that much of a difference between the economic, levels of living of today's global South and today's global North.
And, you know, when we talk about, like, especially right now, and we're talking about at this climate change summit and, you know, global South countries are talking about this big debt owed to them, I don't think people really understand the amount of wealth that has been stolen and stripped away from the global South by colonial powers over the centuries. And you've done a lot of work on this. So can you give our listeners and viewers an idea of just, you know, how much wealth has been stolen by the colonial powers from the global South? And it would be great here if you could maybe use India as an example.
Well, I think much more research needs to be done on quantifying the flow of transfers. That is what economists call it, of one directional flow of transfers from the global South to the North, before it became the North. And there's an enormous area which needs to be explored, which has not been explored, about the magnitude of these transfers. In fact, even though in India we have had a literature which extends back to a century, even for India, specific long-term time series of transfer is something you do not find until very recently. The work that I've done that you have just mentioned, because the relationship of colonial subjugation and domination, the institution of slavery in the Caribbean, in Latin America, and for quite a long time in North America as well, the mode of extraction of economic surplus, which differed as far as different countries of the global South are concerned, for example, slave rent from the Caribbean plantations owned by the Europeans, the slave trade itself, and the accumulation through the profits of the slave trade, and the rather different mechanism which was employed not only in India, but also by the Netherlands in Java, by France in Indochina. All these mechanisms and processes are fairly complex. As an economist, I realize how complex they are, particularly because the economic theory that we are taught, which is taken from the universities of the global north and from textbooks which are produced in these universities, do not even recognize the existence of this type of colonial transfers at all. So scholars in this area have to really apply their minds to, first of all, finding out what the appropriate theory is and how the received theory can be modified. For example, in the case of India, we can nowadays quite easily apply Keynesian macroeconomic theory, which is the basis of national income accounting, to build up a series. But of course, that is only a necessary condition that you have to be familiar with this macroeconomic theory, because in the existing literature, the theory relates only to trade between sovereign equal nations. There is no recognition of the special character of colonial trade and exploitation at all. So even the standard macroeconomic relations have to be modified in the light of one's conceptual understanding of what these transfers involved. So it is by no means an easy task. And as I mentioned to you, systematic time series is something which we do not have even for India until very recently, where I have tried to build it up. You have time series presented also by Professor Amir Bagchi in his path-breaking work, A Perilous Passage, Mankind and the Global Ascendancy of Capital. He has also given a time series, but that there again, this book was only published, less than 20 years ago. So, and as far as Southeast Asia is concerned, which was exploited by the French, as far as Java is concerned, exploited by the Dutch, as far as Korea is concerned, exploited by Japan, as far as Britain's other colonies are concerned, no systematic estimates exist at all. So the answer to your question is that there is a lot of work to be, which has to be done by the scholars of these regions. And in particular, while work has been done by some scholars on super exploitation of colonized labor, that is not exactly what we are looking at when we are looking at colonial transfers. We are looking at essentially how the budgetary revenues were used, the revenues which were raised by putting very heavy taxes, both direct taxes and indirect taxes, on the colonially subjugated producers, were used in a very abnormal manner. They were not used in the way that they are used in the metropolis at all. A large portion of the budget was used simply to pay the producers in local currency for the goods that were taken away from them. But since these very same producers had been obliged to contribute the taxes to the budget, you have a situation where they appeared to be paid because there was a market exchange, they were receiving money and they were parting with the goods which were exported by the colonizing power. So they appeared to be paid, but they were not actually paid because the money was coming out of their own money. That money right. that they were paid as payment for their exports was out of their own tax contribution. So all that was happening in the case of India, for example, is that the form of the tax payment that they were made, that they had already made in cash, only changed into kind, that is, into goods. But it still remained tax. They were being taxed out of their goods. They were not actually paid for them. But it was a very clever system which has confused people, including people who are well-trained in macroeconomic theory, because the market is a very good, sometimes market transactions can obscure real relationships. Mm-hmm. And you have to get behind the market transaction to understand what the real relationship was. So this is what has really flummoxed, you know, analyzers for so long.
And what are the lingering effects of this? I mean, you've talked about this in your research about the British colonial drain from India, but a lot of times, you know, and this comes from kind of what you're talking about, is colonialism is just kind of like glossed over in textbooks, and it's thought of as something in the past, but it still has an impact on the way structures exist today. So what are the lingering effects of the British colonial drain on India today?
Well, you know, if you don't mind my saying so, the very formulation of the question is something that I would not conceptually really be very happy with, because the question has to be formulated in the way, what was the lingering impact, or what was the impact then of these colonial transfers on the global north, not just the impact on the global south? Because it was a two-way thing, you see. What they took from the global south is something which, without which, the global north would not be what it is today. There would not be an industrial global north at all, in my opinion. So I would like to come back to the question you've just posed later on, perhaps, about the lingering effects. Okay? And I'd like to really say a few words about the effects at that time. Not the effects now, but the effects at that time. Okay? So, you know, before that, let me just mention very quickly that one of the problems why we don't understand the mechanisms of colonial transfer at all, or the impact it had on the global north, is because we do not have the conceptual apparatus for understanding it. And we do not, in the global south, have the conceptual apparatus because we are taught not to think. We are taught to simply absorb the textbooks which emanate from the northern universities and, you know, just to absorb what is being produced there without, and in fact, the pioneers of economic theory are held up to us as models, you know, as great men, which no doubt in some respects they were, but in other respects, they developed theories which were entirely incorrect and fallacious. That is, only after a lifetime of thinking about these problems, I realized that Adam Smith's invisible hand never existed. It was a ghost in the machine, you know. And what has been ignored there was the very visible hand of the colonizing state. If you take Britain as the first colonizing nation, which built up the largest empire in modern times in the world, then how did it reach that position? It reached that position through systematic state intervention, through systematic wars that were fought between the handful of maritime European nations, you know, the nations which had navies, which had seacoasts, and of course these nations, to recapitulate, were Portugal, Spain, France, Netherlands, Britain, and later on, much later on, they were joined by Germany, Belgium, Italy, and Japan, which were the late industrializers. But in the beginning, it was just this small handful of maritime European nations which went out in a process of violent expansionism, ostensibly to find trade routes. But one thing we must remember is that they fought bitterly amongst each other for controlling trade routes to today's global south. And why did they do so? What was the imperative behind this? And what we have tried to explain in our book, both in our jointly authored book, both in A Theory of Imperialism and Capital and Imperialism, is that the reason, one of the most important reasons, lay in something nobody talks about at all, and they don't talk about it to this day. There is not a single textbook of economics I've come across, not a single book on economic history of the colonial period emanating from northern universities I have seen, which talk about the fact that the cold temperate countries located in today's global north, and located, of course, at that time also in Northern Europe and North America, were extremely poorly endowed when it comes to the primary sector. And the primary sector includes not only all agricultural production, but also the production of other primary materials like energy, you see. And what was the main source of energy in the past, before the 1830s to the 1850s, fossil fuels were not in widespread use at all. The main source of energy for transportation of produce and for human beings, and energy for cultivation, for drawing the plow and so on, that also came from agriculture in the form of feed grains for animals. So the primary sector, the agricultural sector, was of vital importance for any country's development, because this is the sector that gives us our food grains, other foods, our raw materials for processing into manufactured goods. It gives us the energy source. It gives us the material for building, gives us the fibers for clothing. In fact, everything that underpins a nation's standard of living comes from the primary sector. And the endowment of resources from the primary sector in the cold temperate countries was in the past and remains today extremely poor. Now, this is not something, this is a material reality which is not mentioned in any book at all. Because the books that you get, not a single book. I'm prepared to pay you a reward if you can find me a single text with short questions. And economics and history are the subjects I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the books on environment and the books that the scientists write, because they are aware of this. But the most ideological subjects, in a sense, are economics and history, because they serve certain interests. You know, there's certain class interests, both in the global north and the south, that serve national interests. So these are the places where you find the theories which completely ignore material reality. So what we have tried to foreground there is this fact. And later on, I think you also intended to ask me about, for example, oil and the Middle East and so on, or West Asia. Well, oil is also a primary product. And as a matter of fact, to this day, of the total known global supplies of fossil fuels, only 11% is known to be located within the territorial boundaries of today's global north. Only 11%.
Wow.
Almost 90% lies outside their territorial boundaries. They don't have even access to fossil fuels. And of course, because of the, when I talk about the poor primary sector endowment, a lot of it flows from the climate, which they can't do anything about. They could not do anything about it in the past, and they can't do anything about it today, because no amount of technological change under capitalism has so far changed the climate. In the cold temperate countries in which most of today's global north lies, you have only one crop producible in the whole year. In contrast to the warm countries of the global south, where we can produce two crops a year minimum, and in favorable locations up to three crops a year. So already your productivity of land is 2.5 to 3 times higher. It was higher in the past, it remains higher today. And in our book, I have given you a table from, in the book, A Theory of Imperialism, I have reproduced modern data from the Food and Agriculture Organization to show that despite all the technological advance that you have in the most advanced capitalist country, the United States, if you take the output per unit of area in the United States, then China produces 3 times that output per unit of area, that is output per hectare, taking output in physical units, just the tonnage of all the food crops that China produces, the similar food crops that the US produces. And China, by the way, has a smaller total cultivated area. Even India, where the productivity is much lower because we don't have that degree of intensive cultivation as in China, in modern times, we produce 50% more of physical output per unit of area compared to the US. So do not think of the global south as poor. The global south is rich in resources. And had it not been rich in resources, there would have been no reason for these maritime countries of the global north to undertake a very long and difficult journey halfway around the world. And remember, before before the Suez Canal was excavated and became operational in 1869, the West Europeans had to come all the way around the Cape of Good Hope, 14,000 nautical miles minimum, to reach the coast of Eastern Africa and to reach the coast of Western India, and even further to reach to Southeast Asia, to the Spice Islands of Java, and to China. So it was a very long journey. It was a very difficult journey. And you do not undertake external expansionism of that kind and put in so much effort, so much investment, so much manpower, and face the rigors, not only of the journey, but also of the tropical climate and tropical diseases, unless you have a very high stake
right.
in view. And these right. stakes were extremely high for them. And this is not understood, you know, it's not understood to this day. I'll tell you an anecdote. Some years ago, in fact, many years ago now, more than 20 years ago, I was walking along the seashore in Durban with a comrade from the African National Congress. And he was telling me that, look, I think, you know, these white men from Europe, they were just crazy. They came all the way here just for a handful of spices. So this comrade from Durban, I mean, he had been taught that, you know, the Europeans set out to find spices and so on. But that's about all, you know, that's it. But we are not taught that it was much more than spices, you know. It was much more than spices. It was this enormous tropical biodiversity which they wanted access to. And Britain could not even produce grape wine, which at least France could. The Latin European countries, the countries of the Mediterranean region, where you yourself are making this recording from, that is from Lebanon, of course, yes. are better endowed than Northern Europe and North America, because at least you have always had the gift of the grape vine and the olive, yes. you know, which Northern Europeans have not had, and also citrus fruit, which they did not have access to. So we have to remember that the global south is not poor, was not poor, and is not poor in terms of resources. And that is what invited the, you know, the greed of the European powers, which came out to some. And why subjugation? Why was normal trade not enough? Why could they not exchange their goods for goods of the global south? The answer lies in the fact that the populations of the global south simply had no demand for northern goods. They could that's true.
I love that,
They could produce everything they required themselves. They could produce all the, you know, the food that they required. They could produce the manufactured clothing. In fact, India was arguably not only the largest producer of cotton textiles, but also the largest exporter in the world, right up until the early 19th century. And similarly for China, the Chinese emperor, when he was writing a letter to George III, who had sent an envoy to argue ask for trade concessions for the British to trade in China, said that, you know, our kingdom has everything it needs. We do not need to trade. But since you cannot do without our pottery, our tea, and our silks, the European populations have a demand for our products, we allow you to set up, a trading post in Canton. So it was really a one-sided demand. And what in economic terms it meant was that there was a continuous flow of silver from Europe to today's global south to settle the trade deficit they had, because they imported much more than they could manage to export of their own products. So, you know, a trade deficit always has to be settled through outflow of international money. And the international money was gold and silver that was accepted all over the world. So the European nations found that they had a continuous drain of silver to the global south. So the fact that they introduced trade at gunpoint arises from the fact that they wanted our goods, they wanted the goods of the global south free. They wanted these goods without paying anything for it. And this is a fact which, of course, not a single textbook, not a single book emanating from universities in the global north will admit to.
Okay. Well, yeah, because admitting to that would be basically admitting to the fact that they can't survive without the global south and without taking from, they have nothing to give in return. I mean, that's a really wonderful way to put it.
Yeah. So I think you asked a question about the magnitude of the transfers. Now, I started work on trying to measure the magnitude a long time ago, in fact, 20 years ago. And the first article I wrote on this, which is a long article, was titled The Free Lunch, Transfers from the Tropical, and the subtitle was something to the effect that the role that transfers played in the Industrial Revolution in England. Because there, in fact, for the very early period, from the 1760s onwards, when Clive acquired the Diwani of Bengal, that is, when he acquired the right to collect revenue from Bengal, from the Mughal emperor. That is when the transfers really start, because that is when the East India Company starts using a part of the revenues they collected from Bengal to buy the goods that they needed, which is, as I've said, a very abnormal use of revenue. And in fact, when Clive first got the right of collecting revenues in 1765, the officials of the East India Company really went completely mad with avarice, because they were just a trading company. They were not rulers. For the first time in history, a trading company had actually become a ruler of a very populous and rich province of Mughal India, Eastern India, present-day Bengal, which at that time comprised what today is not only West Bengal, but also Orissa, Bihar, and what is today Bangladesh. So it was a very large province, agriculturally very rich. So they went completely mad, and they used local mercenaries to jack up the rate of revenue collection over 5 years from 1765 to 1770. They trebled the collection of revenue from the peasants and artisans in Bengal. And obviously, the previous ruler, who was a, you know, feudatory of the Mughal emperor, had been collecting sufficient already. So if you treble the revenue collected over 5 years, then what will happen? They took away the seed corn, they took away the what the peasants required for their own consumption. So there was a massive famine. And the officials of the East India Company, the senior officials who came from England, who toured Bengal, said that roughly about 10 million people had died of starvation in Bengal out of a total estimated population of 30 million. So remember, when we talk about the Bengal famine, British rule in India started with a massive famine in Bengal, which is again not talked about in the literature at all, including the literature which emanates from Western educated Bengalis, that is, people who were educated in Western universities or even in Indian universities, but reading the textbooks which emanate from the global north and who are born and brought up in Bengal, you will not find any mention of the magnitude of the Bengal famine, even in their work. So the extent of intellectual colonization is something, Rania, that I would wish all of us to be aware of, because it is not as though it is only people in Northern universities who don't talk about it. Even our own intellectuals are so completely intellectually hegemonized by the discourse and the fallacious theories which come from the global norm, they don't talk about it either. So 1/3 of a population being killed is no joke. Or dying of starvation is not a joke, you know. And that is why it took Bengal, you know, more than 30 years to recover from that. When Cornwallis came after his defeat in North America, you know, the North American settlers attained independence from British colonial rule. Cornwallis was out there and he was defeated. He came, sailed all the way to India. And he instituted the permanent settlement of Bengal, where he told the landed proprietors in Bengal that, look, at the end of 1791, they put a revenue demand on the Bengal proprietors, which would be fixed forever. And he said, I'm giving you a very good deal. The revenue demand is pretty high. It's stiff, but it is not going to increase. Now, why did he do that? Because he wanted the population to recover. There had been huge depopulation and fall in output. For the population to recover, for output to recover, so that the British could continue to get a high level of taxes, the permanent settlement was necessary. But they did not make a permanent settlement anywhere else in India after that. Okay, and the reason for the permanent settlement, again, is not discussed anywhere in the literature. Mm-hmm. Now, as to the magnitude of the drain, you see, the actual magnitude which I compute is a gross underestimate. Because I have only taken the export surplus of commodities that went to Britain for the early period. I had taken the commodities which went not only from India, but also from the slave plantations of the Caribbean that Britain owned. That is from the West Indies. So the transfer from the West Indies, from India, and the transfers from Ireland, because Ireland was also a colony of Britain, British landowners took away land from the peasants in Ireland, and they themselves constituted themselves as the landowners, and they extracted rent from the Irish peasants, who were reduced to a terrible state of being really completely pauperized because the rent rates were so high, and the Irish were also taxed. So the early estimate I made was from all three regions, from the West Indies, from India, which at that time from 1765 to the 1820s primarily was really Bengal, because the tax system in India was extended only from the early 19th century to other parts of India. So, and Ireland, Asia, and the West Indies. And that estimate is the trade deficit that Britain had, which it did not have to pay for, because in the case of the Caribbean, it was slave rent, which was pure economic surplus they took in the form of commodities. In the case of Bengal, again, it was paid for by taxes raised from the same population who produced the commodities. And in Ireland, it was taken in the form of land rent. So that estimate came to about between 5.5% to 6.5% of Britain's GDP, gross domestic product in Britain, from 1770 to 1820. That is the British period of the first industrial revolution in Britain. And without this transfer, that industrial revolution would not have either taken place at all, or would have taken place, if at all, over a very much longer period. Because my estimates show, and I'm using the trade data that the British economic historians themselves have put down in the volume edited by Mitchell and Dean, called British Historical Statistics, and the compilation by Ralph Davis in his very important book, which again is not referred to enough, you know, The Industrial Revolution and British Overseas Trade. So there you have the time series data. I'm using those data of their historians, which their own historians have not used. And it comes to between 5.5% to 6.5% of Britain's GDP, and it practically doubled the rate of capital formation in Britain between 1770 and 1820. Now, this is very important to remember. It is not just the effects in the global south. Industrialization itself, the industrial revolution which in Britain, which acted as a locomotive which then pulled along other European countries, would itself would not have taken place in the form that it did without colonization and the colonial transfers. Very important. So we have to look at it from the point of view both of the global south and the global north. It's an interactive process of exploitation which led to industrialization at one pole and which led to pauperization and actually deindustrialization at the other pole. Because I said my estimates were an underestimate because I have not taken account at all of the fact of the discrimination against the manufacturing industries of the global south. Because we were manufacturers. We were not simply primary producers. Mm-hmm. We had a huge manufacturing sector. India had an enormous manufacturing sector, dominated by textiles, but also metallurgical products. Manufacturers of all descriptions, of course, not on a factory basis, on an artisanal basis. China, similarly, had a very large manufacturing sector of silk, of cotton, and of other products of daily use. And in the case of India, there was active discrimination by Britain to throttle our manufacturing sector. For example, the British kept their economy protected against the inflow of Indian textiles. From the year 1700 until 1774, for three quarters of a century, there was a complete ban on the import of textiles from both India and Persia, by the way. Because before that, there used to be textile imports. The East India Company imported vast volumes and values of textiles from India and from today's Iran. Not only cotton textiles, but also woolen textiles, silk textiles from China, and of course, carpets and so on from Persia. So there was a complete ban on that. And the 1700 Act was passed in Parliament in order to protect the British woolen industry, because the woolen manufacturers complained that our custom is going away because of the imported products. Actually, they were not losing very much custom, but they were afraid of the imports. So there was a complete ban, and the ban lasted until 1774. That is three quarters of a century. And let me again stress that the historians of industrial revolution in Britain, if you look at David Land's book, which is on technical change in the British cotton textile industry, the title is very nice title, The Unbound Prometheus, and a very useful book, but no reference to the protection of the British market against Indian and Persian textiles, no reference at all. If you look at the Marxist historian, Eric Hobsbawm, very renowned name, then again, Eric Hobsbawm in Industry and Empire and his subsequent books has no reference at all to the discriminatory protectionism exercised against India and Persia for three quarters of a century. No reference. Why?
Wow.
Why? After all, Eric Hobsbawm was a Marxist, you know. But the Marxist discourse itself has been hegemonized to a very large extent by the dominant discourse, which was set in motion by Adam Smith and David Ricardo. So it is very important, in my view, when you're asking me about transfers, magnitude of transfers, to understand that we have to get away from this domination. And when I started reading, I was completely dominated also. I studied for my doctoral thesis in Oxford University, but then I transferred to Cambridge because my spouse got a job in Cambridge. So I've studied both under supervisors in Oxford University, UK, and in Cambridge. And a very wonderful Marxist economist was my second supervisor that I had in Cambridge University, Maurice Dahl, who wrote the book called Studies in the Development of Capitalism, which started the famous Dobbs-Suessy debate, you know, on the transition from feudalism to capitalism in Europe. I'm sure you must have heard of the Dobbs-Suessy debate, which was followed later on by the so-called Brenner debate on similar themes and so on. So even with my supervisor, who I really looked up to tremendously, and I used to teach his book myself to my own students when I came back to India for decades. But when I look at that book now, I find that, again, there is really no awareness at all of the importance of to British industrialization of colonial transfers. Long-distance trade is mentioned in Dobbs' book, Studies in the Development of Capitalism, but only in terms of the high profit rates that the various companies, the East India Company and other companies, enjoyed, and the high profit rate from the slave trade. But the fact that it was not just profit rates, the fact that they acquired control over the taxation capacity of a population which was several times the population of Britain in Asia, the fact that they seized assets, huge land assets in North America and Central America from indigenous population, it was simply asset grabbing. because the indigenous populations were massacred, the remnants were driven into reservations. So this enormous land assets of North America, and it's 3,000 miles, you know, from the Atlantic to the Pacific coast. So these huge assets were seized by the maritime Europeans who then migrated there and settled there. Now, those processes of primitive accumulation are not actually mentioned, are not actually discussed in any kind of detail, nor is the slave trade discussed. The fact that, West Africans were physically kidnapped from there. And after all, why were the profits of the slave trade so high when you think about it? They were so enormously high because, you know, when slaves were, when people were enslaved, when free people were enslaved and treated as commodities, those who engaged in the slave trade did not pay for those slaves treated as commodities. All they paid for was some guns and, a few manufacturers, including cloth that they imported free from India, to the mercenaries they hired to kidnap the West Africans. Now, kidnapping and transporting people is not the same as paying for the cost to the communities, even if you think in capitalist terms, in very inhuman terms, of human beings as commodities. They did not pay. They did not pay the communities for the cost they had incurred for raising them from childhood to adulthood to a position where they could be of use to the slave drivers. There again, they got human beings free. They only paid for the cost of transporting them, kidnapping and transporting them across the Atlantic. That is why the profits of the slave trade were so enormously high. And of course, they did not care what proportion of the slaves died on the way because they were crammed like worse than cattle in the holds of the ships and so on. So this, this disgusting history of the rise of capitalist industrialization is something you do not really find discussed adequately in the literature which emanates from the northern universities. And I think it is about time that more people in the global south got down to writing their own history and to writing it not contaminated by the fallacious theories which they are forced to learn from, but to look at these theories critically. Now, one theory I have tried to look at critically, because immediately when I studied Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage, I knew there was a problem with it. There was a very big problem. There was a logical fallacy in it. But it is one thing to realize there's a fallacy in the theory, but another thing to pinpoint it. Where exactly is the fallacy? Because Ricardo was an extremely intelligent person. His formal level of formal argumentation was so high, so good. There is nothing wrong in his formal argument, which says that, he takes a two-country, two-good model. The two countries were Britain and Portugal. The two goods were woolen cloth in Britain and wine in Portugal. And he says that even if Portugal produced both cloth and wine at a lower cost per unit than Britain did, it would still be beneficial for these two countries to specialize and enter into exchange depending on where the relative cost advantage lay. That is, if Portugal produced wine relatively more cheaply than it produced cloth compared to Britain, then Portugal should specialize in wine production. Britain should specialize in cloth production. And if they exchange, then actually the output would increase. They could each enjoy a higher level of consumption of one good for the same level of consumption of the other good in the post-trade situation compared to the pre-trade. There's nothing formally wrong in the argument at all. But what was wrong in the argument is in the assumption. The assumption is that both the countries could produce both the goods. But England could not produce grape wine because grapes could not be grown in the field in Britain. The climate did not permit it, particularly not at the time that Ricardo was writing in the 18th century, because Britain is too cold. You can grow grapes in river valleys in France or even in Germany, but not in Britain. Okay, I believe the situation now has changed. You have genetically modified crops, so people are trying to grow some grapes in the Thames Valley, but at that time, no. And Ricardo also uses a very strange term. He says if Britain were able to grow wine, you know, at a lower cost than Portugal, then you could have the reverse. You could have Britain growing wine, all the wine, and Portugal producing all the cloth. Now, what is this grow wine? This is the term Ricardo uses. If it had been an Indian writing or even a Lebanese writing, I would say bad English. No knowledge of English language. But Ricardo's forebears had immigrated from Spain two generations earlier. He was an Englishman. So it was the use of the term grow wine is a verbal fallacy, which is undermining his material fallacy. The material fallacy is the assumption both countries can produce both goods. That is not true. Tropical goods cannot be produced, could not be produced then, cannot be produced today in cold temperate lands. Let's get that quite clear. So Ricardo's assumption was wrong. And where the assumption is not true, the conclusion of the argument is false. It is not true. It is not true that both countries benefited from the trade. One country certainly benefited. And the reason the trade was undertaken was not because Portugal thought it would benefit from the trade, but because Britain used a superior naval power and diplomatic finesse to impose a treaty on Portugal, under which Portugal was obliged to allow Britain access to its ports in exchange for wine. And, Portugal avoided deindustrialization because British cloth poured into Portugal. That was the condition of this treaty, that Portugal would buy British cloth and sell wine in exchange. So this cloth came into Portugal, and what would normally would have happened, it would have displaced Portuguese producers of cloth, would have produced unemployment for them. This partly happened. It would also have produced lower grain output in Portugal because, you know, area would have been diverted to wine production. And this did happen. Portugal did suffer a fall in its grain output. These are the two important results of free trade. Deindustrialization and fall in domestic food grain output as your land resources get diverted to export crops. Okay? Now, I want to impress upon everyone the importance of looking at the economics of it. There is a politics of imperialism, you know, there is a cultural dimension and ideological dimension to imperialism, but the economics of it underpins it all. And the economics of it is fairly simple. It is just that people don't talk about it at all. That is, the books we read don't talk about it at all. You know, the courses we are taught don't talk about it at all. It is just put under the carpet, swept under the carpet, the material reality. And this material reality of deindustrialization and fall in food grain output is a material reality which was true in the past. It is true today. Okay? So that is the connection between the past and the present, which I'll expand on a bit later. But to come back to your question about the magnitude of the drain, since I've not taken account of deindustrialization, I've taken the export surplus as the measure. What is the export surplus? It is exports of our commodities minus what we import from the colonizing country. But then what we imported under duress. We did not import out of our free will. Because the colonizing country closed its markets to our export of manufactured goods. And then it opened our markets wide to dumping of its manufactured goods on our market. So if I take the imports from the metropolitan power and subtract it from our exports, I'm actually underestimating the adverse impact. Okay? So my measure is an underestimation. I've not taken account. I could have taken account of it by saying that, you know, India was the largest producer of cotton textiles in the world. Why on earth? And it produced the raw cotton. Britain had to import the raw cotton. It is incapable of producing raw cotton itself then or now. It had to incur all the cost of importing the raw cotton across the Atlantic from the southern states of the US. And later on, during the Civil War, all the way through the Suez Canal from Egypt and through the Suez Canal from India. So why on earth should India be importing cotton textiles from Lancashire? The reason was that the British market was closed to Indian textiles, but the Indian market was kept forcibly open to dumping by off Lancashire textiles. Okay, so that import is something which was not the result of the choice of Indians at all. So I could have made an estimate in which I cut down the imports by that amount and get a much larger export surplus from India as a measure of the day. I have not done that. I have deliberately kept it an underestimate. Okay. And that export surplus amount was obtained, as I've mentioned, through a very clever financial instrument. That is the council bills. Now, you know, I don't want to just talk about the estimate without talking about the way one arrives at the estimate, because that would be really dumbing down the discourse. You know, I know that there's been a lot of discussion online. I myself am not on any of the online platforms. I don't read anything on Twitter.
You aren't missing out. Good for you. And I'm very jealous that you're not reading Twitter. Your life must be much better than most of us who spend too much of our day consumed by social media.
But it's more or less a deliberate choice, because there has to be some amount of dumbing down of the discourse, you know?
Yes.
And as an academic, I wouldn't like that. You know, I just don't want people talking about $64 trillion of drain and not understand what the mechanism was. I think the mechanism is far more important than the actual figure. Because, you know, the figure will differ depending on what kind of interest rate you apply. Because, you know, what I'm doing is a method that Keynes also used, a method which Montgomery Martin, a very acute observer, a British observer, probably from Scotland, judging from his name, he wrote a book about the drain from India as far back as 1838, and he gave evidence to a select committee. So, you know, there is a very old discourse, but after 1857, the mechanism of the drain changed. Before that, it was very simple. East India Company was simply using a part of the revenues it collected to buy export goods directly from the producers. But after 1857, when the Crown took over, when the British government directly took over from the East India Company and started ruling India, the mechanism became more complex, but it's not so complex that a layperson without any economics cannot understand it, if it is explained properly. So you have this mechanism in which now India's export goods are going all over the world, and there's a huge demand for it, which is growing in continental Europe, which is industrializing, in North America, later on in Latin America, and also in Japan, which are all. Why? Because particularly the global north, which includes continental Europe, North America, and Japan, need the commodities, not only the raw materials, but also food, which they themselves cannot produce at all because of the monocrop, the single cropping, which is imposed by their climate. And in fact, even the goods they can produce in their summer, they cannot produce in their winter. They have to import it from the global south. So the seasonality factor is also there. So there was an enormous increasing demand for the goods from the global south. And it was earning gold and foreign exchange. What happened to all that gold and foreign exchange that we earned, that our producers earned? And Africa was being brought under colonial rule. Similarly, African produce started going out to the metropolitan countries. Latin American produce started going out. It was a global system of flows from the global north to the south of commodity. But what happened to the exchange? What happened to the foreign exchange and gold that was earned? In the Indian case, all of it went into the account of the Secretary for State of State for India in Council, who was a minister of the British government. He held one of the two most important portfolios of the British government. All of it went into his account. Why did it go into his account? Why did it not come back to the Indians who had earned it? Well, they used this very clever mechanism where the Secretary of State said to foreign importers of Indian goods who had to send payment for their goods to the Indian exporters, they said, look, you need to send payment. Give your dollars and your francs and your Deutschmarks and your sterling. And remember, most of the period, there was a system of fixed exchange rates. So you can express all your dollars and francs and etc. in terms of sterling. So I'll just talk about gold and sterling. So deposit your gold, your silver, and your sterling payment for your imports from India with me. And I will issue you a bill of exchange to an equivalent amount in rupees. You send that bill of exchange. Supposing I'm an American importer of Indian goods. I bought $1,000 worth of goods. At that time, the exchange rate of the Indian rupee to the dollar was 3 rupees could buy one US dollar. Now it is 72 rupees. So at that time, 3 rupees bought one US dollar. So you have to send 3,000 rupees, pay 3,000 rupees to the Indian exporter. You give me your $1,000 to me, I will issue you a bill for 3,000 rupees. You send that bill either by post or by telegraphic transfer to the Indian exporter. He puts that bill in an exchange bank in India and he is paid rupees. What is not mentioned in any book, including in Keynes's book, Indian Currency and Finance, is that the rupee payment to the Indian exporter came out of taxes in the Indian budget. So it came through the exchange banks, but it came out of the portion of the Indian budgetary revenues, which was earmarked all through as expenditure in England. So roughly about one third on average, but it fluctuated between a quarter to sometimes it could go up to even 40% of the total Indian budgetary revenues was being paid out to Indian exporters. Now the actual producers of the export goods were precisely the people who were the taxed, as in the form of direct taxes. In the case of the peasants, they had to pay the land revenue, or they paid rent to their landlords, who in turn paid land revenue. So they were paying the taxes into their taxes comprised the budgetary revenues. Or they had to pay indirect taxes in the form of the salt tax, which made salt 7 to 8 times more expensive in British India because salt was kept a colonial government monopoly. They were paying the taxes. And again, it was out of their own taxes that they were being paid when the council bill was being encashed. The only difference is that now you have a bill of exchange. That's all. That is the only difference compared to the situation under the East India Company. But it was such a clever mechanism that it fooled everybody. Okay? And it is really the measure I'm taking of the drain from India is the value of the council bills, which is expressed in the statistical abstracts for British India, both in pound sterling as well as in rupees. So the Secretary of State for India in London had a claim on the revenues, that part of the budget revenues in India. You do not have this situation anywhere except in a colonial system. So the question I would like to ask the scholars from Indonesia, the scholars from Indochina, from Malaysia, from Vietnam and so on, is have they looked at how the budgetary revenues were being used by the Dutch, by the French? Because I have no doubt at all that the Dutch were not importing enormous quantities of goods from Java, all that sugarcane and all that timber and so on. And they were actually paying for it, not at all, because the Javanese had no demand for Dutch products. Similarly, the Vietnamese and other residents of colonial Indochina had very little demand for French products. What could France export to them? They already produced everything themselves. So it must be the case that not only the British in India, but also the Dutch in Java, the French in Indochina were doing the same thing. They were actually using taxes collected locally, and they were defrauding the local producers by not actually paying them the rupee or the local currency equivalent of their foreign exchange earnings. So two things were happening. The entire golden foreign exchange went into the British Treasury in the Indian case. Okay, Britain did not have the capacity to earn the extent of gold and foreign exchange which is actually recorded in the British balance of payments through its own domestic exports. It could only build up an enormous, as it were, you know, store of gold in foreign exchange, which served to actually settle its trade deficits with continental Europe and with North America. Through all these gold and foreign exchange, which it appropriated from the colonies by defrauding the producers, by not paying them, by so-called paying them out of their own taxes, which meant that it taxed these goods out of them. So that is the measure of drain. And it is a very conservative measure, and that is exactly equal to what is recorded in the statistical abstracts for British India as expenditure in England. And this is what has puzzled observers. How could rupees in the Indian budget become pounds spent by England? So this is the mechanism through which it happened. They kept all the sterling that Indians earned and all the gold, and they simply paid the local producers out of their own taxes. The same system was continued as before. It's not very difficult to understand, is it? I think even if you're not an economist, you can get the point. In fact, it's mainly the economists who are puzzled, because they are trained in Keynesian macroeconomics. They can't get their heads around this peculiar system of colonial exploitation, which is not there in bilateral relations of trade and investment between two sovereign countries. It does not exist. It only exists in the bilateral relationship of trade and investment between a subjugated colony of conquest and the metropolitan power. It's a special system which was set up by them. And the metropolitan economists kept quiet about this. They didn't want the local people to, local intellectuals to get wise to what they were doing. So if you read John Maynard Keynes's book, the first book he ever wrote, the first job he ever had was in the India office in London. The first book he ever wrote was Indian Currency and Finance in 1913, based on his experience gathered there. It gives you the accounts of the Secretary of State for India in Council, the debits and the credits. Now, in the credit part, he does not mention what the Secretary of State was actually receiving. He was actually receiving gold and foreign exchange from the world as its payment for Indian export. He doesn't mention that. He only mentions on the credit side the rupees that the Secretary of State claimed from the Indian budget. So no mention of the gold and sterling at all. And this is deliberate, I'm sure. It is not accidental. Because none of the people at the very top levels of the British financial and economic and administrative hierarchy wanted the actual mechanism to be widely known.
Right.
They knew how it operated, but even the hundreds of British administrators at the local level who spent their lives in India, I doubt if they ever realized how the mechanism actually operated. So that is why we call it a drain at all, because it was not paid for. Okay. And well, the estimate I get is, it was in pound sterling. So it comes to around 13 billion pounds sterling. But of course, if you take it up to independence, Indian independence up to 1947, from 1765 to 1947, then it comes to a little less than half a billion pounds, half a trillion.
Jesus.
Half a trillion pounds sterling, you know, around 500 billion, which is half a trillion pounds sterling. And for up to 2020, it comes to around 13.5 trillion pounds sterling. Now, many people were not very happy with pound sterling, and that reflects the modern situation where the world's reserve currency is no longer the pound sterling. The currency which is considered to be the currency of the global capitalist leader is not the pound sterling anymore, it is the US dollar.
Yes.
So they were more comfortable thinking in terms of the dollar, even for some journal and newspaper interviews that I gave. They said, can't you express it in terms of dollar? The pound sterling meant nothing to them. It was very interesting. So that is how, since the exchange rate of the Indian rupee, of the dollar for the pound sterling, and this was a system of fixed exchange rates, was around 4.5 $85 to £1 sterling. Mm-hmm. So whatever the estimate I have in terms of pound sterling, and that is the basic estimate, gets multiplied almost by 5. Okay? So that's how you get the $64 trillion estimate that some people are talking about. And they say, oh, it's too high and so on. But you must remember actually it's not too high. The compounding is being done at 5% per annum. And the exchange rate at that time, and that is the exchange rate to take, the historical exchange rate of the dollar against the pound sterling, what that was, that the American citizen had to pay almost $5 to buy £1 sterling. Because Britain was the world capitalist leader at that time. Of course, it was the world capitalist leader only because its economy floated on the enormous sums of money that it took from its colonies, the enormous commodities that it took and sold all over the world and kept all the gold and foreign exchange for itself, the enormous degree of defrauding that it did of the colonized producers. Okay, that was the reason that Britain was the world capitalist leader. Okay, so that I think answers that part of your question. We can come to the effects of modern times.
I wanted to talk to you about how, you know, post-decolonization, like how did the neoliberal economies adapt after the Second World War to maintain their dominance? Because now we're going from a colonial system to something that's different but maintains a lot of these subjugationist relationships. And then I want to touch on how this neoliberalism, which is something that you and Prabhat Patnaik write about in your newest book, how that's leading to this kind of rise of neo-fascist movements. So could you start by just briefly talking about that transition after World War II between what we would call the colonization period to now this kind of different sort of imperialism that maintains that dominance, and how that dominance is maintained through this new system?
Okay, let me talk a bit about the whole rise of neoliberal policies first. You see, after decolonization, a country like India had a period of almost 40 years, you know, 4 decades, in which it tried to de-link from the old patterns of colonial trade. It built up a system of protecting petty peasants and artisans who had been so badly exploited all through the colonial period, culminating in the Great Bengal Famine of 1843-44. Because as you perhaps know, if you've read my our chapter in the book and my earlier paper on the Bengal Famine, 3 million civilians died in Bengal during the Second War over a period of 18 months solely because Britain placed the burden of financing the operations of Allied troops countering Japanese advance in South Asia. It placed the whole financial burden on the Indian budget. It was this last act of, you know, exploitation and appropriation from the Indian people. Of course, it promised to pay back a certain part of the expenditure that was undertaken. But in effect, it paid back very little at the end of the day. And in the meantime, there was a huge explosion of expenditure, a sevenfold explosion of public expenditure to finance Allied troops, because they had to be fed, they had to be clothed, they had to be transported, they had to be housed in barracks. So there's a huge war boom, which was financed primarily through printing money. And that most of the spending was in Eastern India, and that led to a hyper sort of inflation. So that is how food went out of the reach of the ordinary mass of the people who had to buy food from the market. There was no rationing system for them. There was only a rationing system for the people directly involved in war production. So the price was paid by 3 million civilians who died of starvation. And this included at least 1 million children aged 14 years or less. So in my paper, original paper, I called it a genocide by economic means. The fact that it was a genocide by economic means, that the inflation was deliberate, it was a method of raising resources from the Indian people, is something that has not been recognized to this day. It has not been recognized to this day. And After this traumatic experience, which the, you know, the patriotic leaders of the Indian National Congress and of the left movement, the Communist parties, all lived through. It was a lived experience for them, seeing the Bengal famine before their eyes. They said, never again. We have to prioritize food security for our population. For this, we have to build barriers to the free export of food. Even if the global price is high, it doesn't matter. Until our own population is fed, we are not going to export. So we have to de-link from the exploitative operation of the global market, because that in the past has always meant that the global north has sucked away produce from our lands at the expense of inflicting hunger and starvation on our own people. So a system of cornering off the economy from global trade was undertaken, and most other decolonizing countries did that. But they had very little time to do that. For example, the African countries' decolonization only took place in the 1960s. And already by the late 1970s, they were in debt to the Bretton Woods institutions, to the World Bank and IMF and so on. India had a relatively longer period, which we call the Nehruvian period. Though Nehru died in 1964, these policies continued, of basically protecting the peasants and the artisans from this exploitative pull of the global market, which was one-sided and which led to hunger and even starvation. So that continued roughly until the late 1980s. And the most adverse impact of colonial rule, apart from huge unemployment inflicted on our people because of the dumping of manufactured goods on an unprotected Indian market, deliberately kept open while the metropolitan market was protected. So apart from the deindustrialization, the most important impact had been in diversion of our land from production of food grains, which our own populations needed, towards production of exported crops, which also included irrigated food grains. You see, even though Argentina was a huge producer of grain, the British continued to import wheat from us because they got it free from India. They didn't have to pay for it. Whereas the, from countries like Argentina in the 20th century, they had to pay for it. You know, Argentina was no longer a colony. So they continued to import irrigated grain. They continued to import commercial crops, non-food grain crops. And even though our land is much more productive than northern countries' land, there is a limit, you know, it's limited in area. So you cannot keep diverting land and resources to fill up, to meet the metropolitan needs without something giving. And that something which gave was domestic food grain production and availability. The people were impoverished. The purchasing power went down drastically, because surplus budgets had been operated for the best part of two centuries. All the things I've been talking about, the mechanism of the drain, was essentially operating surplus budgets. Much more was being collected in taxes from the people than were being spent domestically. Only 2/3 was being spent domestically. The rest was being spent abroad, effectively. So these were surplus budgets. So in Keynesian terms, when you operate surplus budgets, it leads to unemployment, you know, and a depression of incomes. So income generation and employment were very badly affected. In addition to the loss of purchasing power, you had a physical diversion of land to export crops and a physical fall in output of rice and wheat availability for the domestic population. So increasing hunger in colonized India until by 1946, we had reached the level of 137 kilograms per capita per annum of grain production, grain availability. That is not just production, but even taking into account a small amount of import, what was actually available to the poor. Now, not a single country in the world today, not even the least developed countries, have such a low level of grain availability as our population had by 1946. The year before the British finally quit India after almost 200 years of unbelievable exploitation, which has still not been fully documented so far. So that is the adverse impact. The moment you open up to global trade, which is northern trade, trade which is dominated by the demand of the northern countries, you find that your food grain production and availability for your domestic population goes down. Mm-hmm. So the neoliberal economic policies which were brought in, of course, affected advanced country populations also, because they involved measures of austerity, of the state cutting back, you know, on expenditure, on direct investment, on the social sectors, on health and education, which has impacted also the poor in northern countries. But in the southern, in the global south, the impact has been very much greater, because the historical legacy of huge unemployment, labor reserves, enormous labor reserves, you know, which we can no longer absorb the way the British or the French did, because we do not have empty lands to migrate to. Lands right. which have been emptied of local populations through massacres and the local populations being driven into reservations. And thank God those mechanisms are not open to us, because they are ethically unacceptable. So we do not have the safety valve of out-migration on a huge scale and settlement of new lands that today's industrialized countries had in the past and which they employed to the hilt. And therefore, the you know, the impact on the southern population is much more severe of neoliberal policies. And we know what those policies are. They've been so widely discussed. I don't need to spell it out. Only the two main pillars. One is that the so-called withdrawal of the state is not a withdrawal of the state. It is the active intervention of the state to make sure. And I think somewhere when Chomsky has very correctly put it, it is a war of the neoliberal state on the on their own poor in every country. Mm-hmm. That is this kind of cutting back on direct investment, on public goods, on the supply of public goods, on health, education, and so on, healthcare education, is something which has impacted, which impacts the southern populations to a far greater extent. But of course, there are no so-called safety nets either. There are no unemployment benefits and so on. The whole business of unemployment benefits or some safety nets was in fact brought in a country like Britain and other European countries in Scandinavia only after the experience of the Second War. So for a brief, less than three decades, you had Keynesian you know, expansionary policies being followed in these countries. You had the long post-war boom, social security, a system of social security being instituted in the advanced countries. But the global south had nothing of that, you know. There's no system of social security at all. There's no unemployment system of unemployment benefit. There is no system of guaranteeing food security. So this was a system which was sought to be established, food security, through the setting up in India of the Food Corporation of India, which undertook to procure at a minimum support price from the peasant producers grain as well as other crops. Later on, other crops were added, and other commodity boards were formed which procured you know, commodities, the cash crops as well, like cotton, you know, tea, coffee, spices, and so on, at a minimum support price, which meant that the price, market price, was not allowed to fall below that. Okay, so this was set up during the Nehruvian period. And all this, both the cornering off from the global market, is absolute anathema to the advanced capitalist countries and to the international financial institutions. So they want the reinstitution of free trade. They wanted all trade barriers to be broken down. And the agreement on agriculture, which was formulated in advanced countries, if you look at the provisions of that, the provisions are basically to open up the agricultural sector of the global south, the primary sectors of the global south, completely to free trade and to the penetration of the northern transnational agribusiness corporations. Okay, because they want access to the lands of the more productive lands of the global south. As I've said, the climate has not changed. Global right. warming is a terrible thing, but global warming is not going fast enough for Colorado to be able to produce cotton, okay, or for Germany to be able to produce raw cotton, right? I mean, it's a very slow process. Okay, thank goodness. If you can proceed further, then, you know, lots of our low-lying islands would be, in the tropics would be inundated.
Right.
It's good.
Yes.
It's going very slowly, right? So they still need our land to fill the supermarket shelves in the global north. Something like 70 to 80% of all supermarket products have a complete or partial input of commodities sourced from the global south. The northern populations are heavily dependent on imports from the global south. And they want the freedom to import without any restriction. They want their agribusiness corporations to come in and access products directly from our farmers. They don't want any minimum support price. The United States has been continuously attacking India. In fact, the entire policy of countries in the global south operating food stocking, procurement of food grains, stocking food grains, so they can provide food to their own population. This has been under severe attack for more than a decade now, and the attack is still going on. Okay, I can give you the specific examples, but we don't have time, of the kind of dishonesty which has been employed. Just 3 years ago, the United States sent a memo to the World Trade Organization saying that India is giving forbidden market price support to wheat to the extent of 2/3 of the value of wheat production, and for rice to more than 70% of the value of its rice production. If you look at the basis of their calculation, they're taking the price at which India was paying minimum support prices way back in the 1980s. Okay. And prices have risen since then more than tenfold. And they say in that memo that basically India should be producing, paying at most the minimum support price they paid in the 1980s, more than 30 years ago. And they're taking the exchange rate of the Indian rupee against the dollar, which was 12 and a half rupees to the dollar then, to make the calculation, whereas the present exchange rate is 72 rupees to the dollar. So the dishonesty in the economics of it, the sheer dishonesty, you know, is just unbelievable. And it's all there. I have done a detailed critique of that. But, you know, you don't get a critique of that, which is direct, from economists in the global south. They are sort of all the time beating around the bush. They won't call the spade a spade, that this is a dishonest calculation. And this calculation has no basis. As a matter of fact, our peasants today are getting a minimum support price. Not all of them are getting it. It's not being implemented properly. They're getting a minimum support price, which is actually below the world market price. So the support is negative. That is where why they're asking for a system of minimum support prices where the prices are reasonable, which allows them to cover their cost of production. And this entire system of food security, of course, once the food grain is procured, the government gives a subsidy out of the budget so that people in the far south of the country, in food deficit states, because they produce a lot of cash crops, like Kerala produces spices and coffee and tea and so on. So the food grains they produce is not enough to feed the local population. Similarly, in the northeast, the food grain production is not enough, but they produce oil, which earns foreign exchange for the country. So the central government has a duty to actually distribute food and to meet the cost of transport over 1,000 miles, 2,000 miles. You know, this is a big country that we have here. You can't expect people in Kerala to pay huge prices for food. The transport cost has to be subsidized, you know, because they are, after all, producing other things which are earning foreign exchange, which goes into the central exchequer. So we cannot give up our system of food procurement and distribution. That is what the farmers today are fighting for in India. And this business of the opening of the Indian economy to global trade, which had already started from the middle of the 1990s, because the neoliberal policies were instituted under pressure from the northern economies, as well as pressure from the World Bank and IMF, open up, do away with, reduce your your price support drastically, do away with tariffication completely, do away with quantitative restrictions, completely, and then convert them to tariffs and then reduce the tariff rates to 3% or something like that. This 3% is a very favorite figure. More than a century ago, The unequal treaties that the Western powers signed with China said you can put tariffs only to the extent of 3%. It's a kind of magic figure. It's practically saying that you have to keep your open economy an open economy. Okay? Yeah. So they love the 3%. And they're still doing it more than a century and a half later. They're still saying at most 3% tariff. You know, so there's a huge continuity if you look at the economic policies. Okay, so this has already led to our farmers being exposed to the volatility, ups and downs of global prices, because effectively for the cash crops, a minimum support price was withdrawn. The state withdrew from the mid-1990s from procuring commodities like spices and coffee and tea. And the transnational corporations came in and directly started contracting with the producers. And they're small producers. These are not huge plantations at all, you know.
Yeah.
Though they produce tea and coffee and so on, they don't do it on large plantations. They're small plots. They're peasant producers. And the transnational corporations, of course, always pass on any fall in prices on the global market. They immediately refuse to lift the crop from the local producers. They violate their own contracts with them. If there's a rise in global pricing, they take the benefit of the rise. So our peasants started committing suicide because they had taken loans in order to grow the cash crops. Growing cash crops generally means a higher cost than growing food grains. So they had taken loans to shift from food grains to cotton production. And Monsanto also got into the act with their genetically modified cotton plant. Most of the cotton plants today are now from Monsanto's domestic subsidiaries providing genetically modified seeds. So they have penetrated Indian agriculture greatly. I was mentioning that because of exposure to global prices going up and down, peasants who had taken loans were unable to pay. And since 1997, more than 300,000 farmers have committed suicide because of indebtedness. This is, of course, a very well-known fact. But now they have lost patience because they waited for so long for the government to take action. But it's very clear that the present government in particular, even the earlier government was pretty callous because, after all, they were succumbing to the pressure to opening up their Indian primary sector, which led to the peasants' suicides in the first place. But the present government has gone one step further with the three farm laws, because these are specifically designed to say that transactions of peasants with buyers need not take place any longer, only within the regulated markets. Now, the regulated markets are where the minimum prices are applied. So if farmers are approached outside the regulated markets, it explicitly says that corporations can enter into direct contracts with the farmers. So basically, the laws are designed to facilitate the entry of the corporate sector, both the Indian corporate sector dealing in farm produce, which is relatively small, but even more dangerously, the very large transnational agribusiness corporations are now being given direct access to our farmers on a legal basis, which was not really the case earlier. So this is what the farmers are protesting against. And it is really for the survival of the entire system of independent, relatively autonomous development and of food security in our country, which has been undermined to a large extent, but which still exists. So these laws, if implemented, would really finish it off completely. So this is a very, very important agitation that they are undertaken and which has been going on now for a whole year.
Well, so you argue in your book that there's a direct connection between this failed economic neoliberalism that you just laid out. There's a direct connection between that and the rise of these neo-fascist movements. So my question for you is, why do we see the rise of these neo-fascist movements as a result of this neoliberalism? And how is it different from the kind of fascism that we saw in the 1930s? And lastly, is it more dangerous, this rise of neo-fascist movements, is this more dangerous for the global South?
Well, that's a question which has so many dimensions that I don't really think I would be able to answer it, you know, in any detail. And it's a very fundamental kind of a question. But you see, the connection between neoliberalism and neo-fascism is clear when you remember that unemployment and loss of livelihoods is what precipitated the rise of classical fascism in Europe. That is the Great Depression. You know, during the Great Depression, people were losing jobs. This provides a very fertile ground for the rise of far-right movements, because it is very easy at that time for these movements to mislead people in the wrong direction. The actual analysis of why capitalism, the capitalist system, is must necessarily give rise to crisis, periodic crisis, is very difficult. It's a very difficult one to convey to even to trained academics, leave alone to the lay population. Okay, the fact that it is a spontaneous system, it's an unplanned system, and therefore it is prone to crisis, you see, it is much easier for a new fascist leader to come in and to rise to power by misleading the ordinary mass of people who are suffering the rigors of the unplanned nature of the capitalist system and capitalist exploitation, to say, no, your jobs have gone because you have allowed the immigrant population in, they are to blame. Or there's a minority in your country, get rid of that minority and you'll be okay. So targeting of immigrants, targeting of a minority, and the use of a kind of great power chauvinism, the use of even more intensive aggression against mm-hmm. other countries to solve your own unemployment problem through militarization, increasing militarization. Because obviously militarization will, in the short run, give rise to jobs. But in the longer run, as we know, from the experience of militarization and of war, it's an absolute disaster in terms of the toll in human lives and human suffering that it takes. But that was the reason, the same reason arises in the case of present-day neo-fascism. That is, the entire neoliberal agenda, one of finance capital, trying to keep the growth rates high, basically by suppressing mass consumption. And finance, as we know, is always goes for the worst alternative. Finance is always extremely afraid of inflation, because the whole basis of the capitalist system is that it operates on the basis of money, the use of money, in a generalized sense, not only for transactions but also as a mode of holding wealth. So that is why in a book that my spouse Prabhat Patnaik wrote more than 10 years ago, The Value of Money, he had already explained in there what is the connection between the value of money in a capitalist society and external drive to control resources, because there has to be a commodity basis, a commodity backing, to maintain the value of money in advanced capitalist societies. You know, money has to be able to buy commodities. If suddenly all prices treble, including the price of coffee and all the things that you consume, and you consume on the basis of imports from the global south, then of course the dollar would no longer be considered a hard currency which is as good as gold. It would not have that status anymore. The US would no longer be financially the leading power. So it is absolutely imperative for them to ensure that the value of money is maintained. And a modern day imperialist expansion, the desire to control oil resources, is what was discussed in that book, The Value of Money. So your later question about oil has already been taken care of, as it were, in that book. Yes. You asked me, you're talking about primary products, but what about countries in West Asia? like Syria and Lebanon and Iraq and so on, which don't export much to the West. But these, the West Asia is the region of oil.
Yes.
You know, the bulk of the world's known oil supplies are located in West Asia. And there's been such an enormous discussion already on the topic of oil politics. You already have, scholars who know far more than I do. Ali Qadri is there, who's writing on West Asia. There's Ejaz Ahmed and so on. So, you know, oil has also been discussed, as I've said in this book, The Value of Money, at great length. Not at great length, but its connection to maintaining the value of money, maintaining the status of the dollar.
Yes.
The oil dollar exchange standard was already discussed in that book. But what we focused on, therefore, was this whole question of the rest of the primary sector, which had not been explained earlier in any other book to our knowledge. So we shifted our focus away from one particular primary product, which is very important, which is oil, which affects West Asia the most, to the other primary products. Now, you see, neoliberalism has run into an impasse, okay, with the various bubbles which sustained it, the dot-com bubble and so on, have now all collapsed. So it is, in order to maintain the value of money, in order to maintain the dominance of the dollar, of its position as the reserve currency, which underpins the position of the United States as the world capitalist leader, to maintain the capitalist system as a whole vis-a-vis the global south, it undertakes income deflation. And income mm-hmm. deflation is something we have discussed at great length. Of course, it practices it within the advanced world itself against its own workers. But most importantly, it practices it against the global south. Okay? So this gives rise to unemployment, because when the state actually cuts back on expenditures, you know, when it reduces its fiscal deficit, and just reduction even to zero is not enough. The international financial institutions, if you have a zero fiscal deficit, then say you have to go to a negative fiscal deficit. That is, you have to collect more in taxes than you actually spend. You have to build up enormous stocks of, reserves, because the global financial situation is volatile. So mm-hmm. your economy could collapse, so you have to guard against that. So countries like India absolutely unnecessarily has global capital flowing in. We don't need that capital. Our current account deficit is very small. We have not needed it in the last 20 years. But this is what the advanced capitalist countries want. They want to penetrate your economies. So they want their capital to come into your economies. So what we are essentially doing is something very irrational we have been doing, and other countries have been doing, China has been doing as well. We are taking money from advanced countries, not so much China, more India, at a high interest rate, and then we are parking it as United States, treasury bonds and so on, treasury paper, at a very low interest rate. So if you do it as an individual, you'd be mad. You don't borrow money at a, 6 to 8% interest rate and then park it somewhere where you get 2% interest rate. Yeah. So that is what developing countries have been forced to do. That is what they've been doing. This is a new form of drain as well, which I don't have time to enter into here. So these policies of exposure of small producers to this kind of cutting back by the state of development expenditure under the neoliberal dispensation, exposure to global price volatility has reduced their incomes, has produced enormous rise in unemployment, which was already high to begin with. Now, this provides a very fertile ground in developing countries for these fascist leaders to come in, and they are saying exactly the same things as Hitler did in Germany, as Mussolini did in Italy. They are pointing to their domestic minorities, they are pointing to religious minorities, to cultural minorities, and they're pointing to immigrants as targets, and they're saying these are the people who are responsible for your... And of course, the advanced capitalist countries are perfectly happy with that. As long as the neo-fascist elites allow the transnational corporations to come in, as they're doing in India, as our present government in India is trying to do through the farm laws that it has rammed through parliament without consultation with the people who are most affected, who are going to be most affected by them. As they have done in other countries where you have the rise of neo-fascist movements, they are all playing ball with the international financial institutions and with the advanced countries. So the advanced countries are perfectly happy to go along with that, you know. And yes, it is a very, very dangerous situation for us in the global south in particular. But the tide is also turning because it's a question of struggle, basically, between two alternative visions and two alternative trajectories. One is the very narrow vision, the narrow extreme right wing and very dangerous vision, which neo-fascism embodies. And the other is the vision which Marxism and the left movement of internationalism envisages. So it is always a struggle between the two. There is no absolute victory at the moment of one side over the other. And therefore, the struggle really has to go on.
Well, Utsa Patnaik, world-renowned Marxist economist. I mean, there's so much more to say and to hear from you about. I hope we can bring you back on at some point in the near future and continue this discussion. Thank you so much for joining me for a very long time to explain all these things.
Thank you.